Before we dive in, I want to take a moment to thank you for being with us here at The World. We are well aware of all the competition for your time and attention, and we are grateful that we are your source for global news. We hope that you find our work clarifying and believe like we do that independent, fact-based journalism is essential for democracy and can help us all gain perspective and make sense out of the noise. We're able to bring you critical reporting on international events because listeners like you support our work. From now until June 14th, we are fundraising with a goal of $25,000. Every gift counts and helps us cover the costs, from reporting trips and keeping our team safe to maintaining audio equipment, all so we can focus on sharing stories from around the world with nuance and with care. We hope you'll consider creating a monthly donation and joining the listeners who help sustain our newsroom year-round. Visit theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give, or use the link in the episode notes to contribute. Thank you for tuning in, and thanks for being with The World. Now, on to the show. Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world. to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you.
A big global gathering starts today at the UN. Among the challenges, what to do with Myanmar and its military junta.
I don't see a pathway forward that would give the Myanmar junta formal acceptance in the international community.
I'm Carol Hills. Also today, the Taliban says women must be covered head to toe. Afghan women abroad are taking to social media with a big no, posting what they consider traditional Afghan dress.
A lot of these dresses are meant for women to dance in them, to, you know, frolic, you know, to be alive and to be animated.
Plus, what went wrong with Boeing's 737 MAX? Turns out the problems started early.
Any kind of thing that went into the design process that effectively increased the cost to the airlines was really looked down upon.
That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We start with a big meeting kicking off in New York today. It's opening day at the 76th session of the United Nations General Assembly. 193 member states are taking part, but two countries present an immediate challenge. The first is Afghanistan. And the question here is whether the UN will officially recognize the Taliban as the legitimate representative of the Afghan government. The other country is Myanmar. It was taken over in a military coup back in February, which was followed by a deadly crackdown by the army. Two governments claim to run Myanmar, so the UN has to decide which one to recognize. The World's Southeast Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen reports on what the UN's decision on Myanmar could mean for the troubled country.
Who deserves to run the country of Myanmar? For a lot of folks, that's pretty obvious. It's the people who won an election last November. Only they are now tormented by a military that has seized power. And instead of sitting in parliament, they're in prison or on the run.
Some of them remain underground in Myanmar. They don't go out. They rely on their relatives to get them food. Many of them have to change locations.
Philip Anavit worked with many of these elected officials as a UN advisor until last year. He still keeps in touch.
Many of them have to use networks of safe houses that have been set up by activists to evade arrest and probably torture by the regime once they get arrested.
While being hunted, these ousted leaders have managed to set up what they call the National Unity Government. It's still making decisions for the country, often over encrypted apps. It has a Ministry of Education holding online classes. Its Ministry of Finance takes in donations, and it even has a brand new army, which is working with armed indigenous groups in the borderlands to overthrow the central military and restore democratic rule. Yes, they even have a battle anthem. What they don't have is any outside country saying, yes, we acknowledge that you are the legit government of Myanmar. But Philip Anavit thinks the UN should say exactly that.
Assuming relations with the National Unity Government as a government would be a major game changer.
It would mean this revolutionary government could get foreign help, like health services, from the UN. Right now, it does treat patients with the help of nurses who defected from government hospitals, but they have to operate in secret. Since the military took over, public services have basically collapsed. Many schools are shut, emergency rooms closed, and people are fending for themselves. Anavit says UN recognition for the elected government is the way to go.
The major turning point in this current resistance and would probably help the National Unity Government and its allies to knock over a struggling junta that has no support in the country.
This shadow government with its armed allies in the borderlands controls about 20% of the country. The military, about 70%. The rest is run by other armed groups that haven't picked sides. So basically, victory for the counter-coup is by no means certain. That is why officials such as Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the United States UN representative, will say things like this.
We will show the military that their actions have consequences.
But so far, the U.S. isn't taking much action. Washington might be afraid to recognize a government that could sputter out in a few months. But here's the thing. Countries that are closer to Myanmar's military, like China, they don't fully recognize the regime either. Because what if the military can't hold power long term? Already, millions of citizens refuse to pay taxes to the military government, and nearly 500,000 government workers won't show up to work. So is the military really running the country? The UN Special Representative for Myanmar, Christine Schreiner-Bergener, says, not really. She told the UN earlier this year that this was only an incomplete attempted coup.
I say attempted, since the takeover has not stabilized. It would appear to be roundly rejected by the people.
The UN has kind of backed itself into a corner. In June, it overwhelmingly approved a resolution telling the regime to back down and reinstate elected officials. Again, here is Philip Anavit, the former UN advisor.
I don't see a pathway forward that would give the Myanmar junta any path to formal acceptance in the international community.
Now, diplomats at the UN, they have a third option, kicking the can down the road, deferring any decision on Myanmar until November, when the committee that decides who's in and who's out will meet next. That's probably what they'll do this week at the UN General Assembly in New York. And while they make up their mind, those are revolutionaries on the march in Myanmar this week with their rifles. Meanwhile, the regime has been torching villages and launching airstrikes. Both sides will now try to gain more ground before November to have a stronger claim to truly running the country of Myanmar. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
And today in Washington, we heard from Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who testified before Congress on the U.S. exit from Afghanistan and its aftermath.
After 20 years, 2,461 American lives lost, 20,000 injuries, $2 trillion spent, it was time to end America's longest war.
Senators from the Foreign Relations Committee put Blinken on the hot seat during the hearing. Here's Republican Senator Rand Paul on how he saw the Biden administration's withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Never in my worst nightmares did anyone or conceive of such a colossal incompetence.
We're joined now by Susan Glasser. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker, where she writes about politics and global affairs. Susan, what was your main takeaway from Secretary Blinken's appearance before the Senate panel today?
Well, this is an administration that is very unrepentant. They are refusing to say mistakes were made even in the execution of the withdrawal. Secretary Blinken, just like President Biden, has been leaning very hard into the decision, certainly broadly supported by the American people, to withdraw from Afghanistan and essentially using that as a broad cover for not really engaging in the specifics of how that withdrawal was carried out.
How do you think Blinken's testimony is being received by U.S. allies abroad, specifically the EU and NATO partners?
You know, I think there were a lot of bruised feelings in Brussels and around the NATO alliance who had been with the United States for the whole 20-year duration of the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan after 9/11. They felt that they had not really been fully consulted or given a voice in both the overall decision by President Biden to end the NATO operations there, but also in the specifics of the withdrawal. So the question is there going to be lasting damage from this, or is it just another example of the U.S. acting in a high-handed and more or less unilateral way when its interests are involved?
I'm curious if there's any criticism over the last 2 days that's really stood out to you, from either Republicans or Democrats.
I do think that it's a sign of these hyper-polarized and partisan times that there can't be a serious conversation in which the Biden administration would be able to acknowledge some of the failures of thinking that led up to this catastrophic collapse of the Afghan government. And they just have been unwilling to do that because the issue has been so supercharged. And so I've been surprised and disappointed by that. I mean, the bottom line is that the president of the United States, Joe Biden, in July 8th said that it was extremely improbable that the Taliban would have any kind of a swift takeover of the country. That's exactly what happened just a few weeks later. How can we not be having a serious and reasonable conversation about that?
How do you assess Blinken's answers to the questions about the tens of thousands of Afghan people who've been left behind, the people the U.S. could not get out in time?
His answers were evasive and unclear. We still don't really understand the universe of those who helped the United States over the course of 20 years who remain in Afghanistan and are eager to leave. We know that those are many, many, many thousands more than those who actually were able to get out in this period of time.
Finally, going forward, will the way the Biden administration handled the exit from Afghanistan go down as a U.S. foreign policy failure?
Look, the whole experiment is going to go down as a U.S. foreign policy failure. That's four straight U.S. presidents. When the world's greatest military power spent 2 decades in a country and then leaves under conditions like this, and that government that was created, propped up, trained, advised, and solicited by the United States collapses within 11 days. That is a black mark on the United States. It's not attributable to any one person, but it is unquestionably a failure and one that will be studied for a long time to come.
But the evacuation took place under Joe Biden's administration, and he's the one who pulled the plug finally. Do you think this will dog him throughout the rest of his presidency?
He will be accountable to that. Now, if history is any guide, the American public has been very disinterested, by and large, in Afghanistan for much of the 2 decades that we've been there. So I'm guessing that the United States leaving and the conditions under which it did so is not going to be more of a public political issue here in the United States than our presence was for the last 2 decades. And I would think, as a matter of politics, it's likely to fade fairly quickly. But as a matter of execution, you know, many presidents have faced foreign policy embarrassments overseas, especially in their first years, and that ends up being a part of the record. And I think that's what we're looking at here with Joe Biden and the Afghanistan withdrawal.
Susan Glasser is a staff writer with The New Yorker. She's been talking with us about Secretary of State Antony Blinken's testimony before Congress about the U.S. exit from Afghanistan. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Between all the wildfires, heat waves, and droughts, it can all feel a bit overwhelming. For young people, the fear and anxiety about climate change are even more pronounced. Today, Bath University in the UK and the Climate Psychiatry Alliance released the results of a new study. They polled 10,000 people between the ages of 16 and 25 across 10 nations. Some 6 in 10 said they are very or extremely worried about climate change. More than half agree with the statement that humanity is doomed.
The powerlessness is really crippling.
Jennifer Uchendo from Nigeria is one of the young climate activists who spoke at a press conference today.
You know, it's something that young people like myself have to grapple with, have to think of. This is something that is really affecting young people all over the world.
The new study bears that out, says Dr. Liz Marks from the University of Bath. She's one of the lead authors of the new study that interviewed young people.
Nearly half told us that this affects their normal daily life. Things like eating, sleeping, going to school, play.
Mark said young people also report having doomsday thoughts about climate change.
Over half think that their family's security will be threatened. Over half think that the things that they most value will be destroyed. And 4 out of 10 are hesitant to have their own children because of climate change.
Of course, climate change won't affect everyone equally. The study shows higher levels of distress in countries already feeling profound impacts. Caroline Hickman, the other lead author of the study, shared what one child told her.
A child in the Maldives said to me, he said, Climate change is like Thanos in the Avengers Endgame, whose ideology is to kill off half the planet so the other half can thrive. And then he said, but the trouble is we're the half being killed off.
Hickman said she knew when she started this research that many children and young people were anxious and afraid. She just didn't know how afraid they were.
A child from my research said to me, I'm scared to breathe the air outside my house. I'm scared of the weather. Do you know what that's like?
Hickman says the anxiety makes sense, though. It's a rational reaction to what kids constantly hear and read. Phrases like an existential threat and a planetary emergency. It may not be the Avengers, but it's still terrifying. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. Sex selective abortion in favor of boys is common in many countries. It's been the practice in the Eastern European nation of Georgia. Marika Kordatze from the United Nations Population Fund says doctors sometimes influence the parent's decision to abort a girl.
Normally, doctors are very biased. Because if a woman goes to get an ultrasound and they already have two girls in the family, and the third one is also a girl, they sometimes they say, oh my God, poor you. It's so, sort of like showing a sympathy that, you know, it's not a boy.
There's been a preference for sons in Georgia for centuries.
Elise Burr writes about foreign affairs for The Economist.
Some traditional families feel like they need a male child to either carry on the bloodline and family name, or they believe that sons will be the ones to take care of parents in their old age, whereas daughters are going to be taking care of their husband's parents. I spoke with Maka Chitavana, an economist at Tbilisi State University's Policy Institute, about why son preference persisted after the fall of the Soviet Union. And she told me that it's really connected to poverty in Georgia.
When you are poor and when you don't trust your government, when you are uncertain about your old age, you try to make sure that you have a son who will take care of you. And that's how it is linked to poverty.
But in recent years, the preference for sons has been decreasing.
Elise Burr explores this on The Intelligence, a podcast from our partners at The Economist.
First, after the initial post-communist economic turmoil, women's wages rose in Georgia. That's beneficial in a couple of ways. First, it can increase women's bargaining power at home. So say a woman might be able to overrule her husband who wants to abort a girl. And that's relevant because in Georgia, preference for sons is more widespread among men than it is among women. When women earn money as well, it might change parents' minds so that they think that daughters will be able to take care of them in old age as well.
So today, there are more girls being born in Georgia. Elise Burr says that in the past few years, the birth ratio between boys and girls is no longer so lopsided. Right now, about 107 boys are born for every 100 girls. Predictions are that that number could drop a bit more. These statistics point toward a slight change in attitudes toward women's roles in Georgian society. But still, attitudes take time to change.
It's not yet a feminist paradise. The sex ratio is still skewed for third children and in some rural communities. I spoke to a group of women about the issue, and not one of them could convince her husband to join the conversation. So that shows that there's still some work to be done when it comes to son preference, especially among men. And even if attitudes do grow less sexist, Georgians still are going to have to face the consequences of previous biases. And next year, Georgians born into the most skewed birth cohort are going to turn 18. Some of those men may need to emigrate if they want to find a bride.
That's Elise Burr of The Economist speaking about sex-selective abortions in the Eastern European country of Georgia. Images from Kabul this weekend showed women in black marching in demonstrations to support the Taliban. The women were wearing long, dark outfits, their faces nearly fully veiled. Recently, the Taliban issued a decree calling for female university students to wear clothing that covers their body and most of their face. Taliban leaders say it's a return to Afghan tradition. Bahar Jalali isn't buying it. She's a former history professor at the American University in Afghanistan. Jalali has launched an online campaign to publicize what she considers to be traditional Afghan dress.
On Saturday, when I saw the images from the pro-Taliban protests by the women, as a historian of Afghanistan, I was just really shocked to see that something that is completely and utterly foreign to Afghan culture was being presented as authentic Afghan attire. Even in the most remote conservative villages of Afghanistan, you will not see that kind of attire. So I was very moved by it. And so I uploaded a picture of myself in a traditional Afghan dress onto Twitter. And another Afghan friend, Paimana Hassad, who's an Afghan-British politician, did the same thing, posted a picture of her in a very colorful Afghan dress. And then when I woke up, it had gone viral, it had become global.
So describe authentic Afghan clothing for women.
The dresses that have been presented on Twitter, on social media, very, very colorful dresses with lots of embellishments, embroidery, adorned different styles from different regions of Afghanistan, you know, alive with decorations. And of course, a lot of these dresses are meant for women to dance in them, you know, to be alive and to be animated. It's really the polar opposite of what we saw at the pro-Taliban women's event, where you see women completely invisible. It's like they're not there. It just looked very staged to me, very contrived. Some people were even commenting, well, perhaps some of them are even men out there.
Bahar, you grew up in Afghanistan. What kind of clothing did you wear at that time?
I wore the same kind of clothing that I would wear in the United States. There was no clothing restrictions back then. People could wear skirts, they could wear pants, or they could wear traditional Afghan attire.
What has the Taliban said so far about what women can wear on the street?
Before the Taliban came to power, there were different styles of headscarves, right? Some people wore the headscarves that really just kind of covered all the hair, covered the head. And then you had the headscarves that were a little bit more loose. And now, of course, all women are going to have to wear those really, really tight, all enveloping cloaks that looks more like what a judge in the United States wears, something that's very completely shapeless. And you really don't no longer can have those diversity of headscarves. It has to be a really tight headscarf that covers a complete head, no hair showing. Before you could show hair, it was not a big deal.
Do we know what the penalty is for wearing something else?
Well, obviously, I mean, before when the Taliban were in power, they would beat women. They would beat their ankles if they were not properly dressed. You know, when the Taliban ruled Afghanistan in the 1990s, you saw women being executed in soccer stadiums for some very, very trivial things. So, of course, that these women are going to be met with severe punishment if they don't follow these dress codes.
It's so interesting because in many respects, talking about clothes seems frivolous, but in the context of Afghanistan, it's very serious.
It is serious because, you know, it really, it's so much more than a fashion show. It's really about something much deeper, heritage, identity, history, how you identify with your country. And so I really hope in the message we really want to get out is that we are facing an assault on our identity, our sovereignty, our culture, our heritage. This is something that we can do from afar. This is something that we can do to try to make people understand that this is the true face of Afghanistan. It's color, it's vibrant, it's alive. It's not something that's been imposed on Afghans by foreign terrorists that really seeks to erase women from society and seeks to erase Afghan culture.
Bahar Jalali teaches history at Loyola University, Maryland. She used to teach at the American University in Afghanistan. She's launched a social media campaign using hashtags including Do Not Touch My Clothes. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. Finnish is known for being a tough language to learn with long words like
epäjärjestelmällistymättömyydellänsä käänkö hän.
We'll hear how the mayor of Helsinki wants to smooth the linguistic path for outsiders, plus the trick to staying really, really fit. Spoiler alert, it's not that fun. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. You ever fantasize about tearing it all up and moving to some far-flung destination? But then there's that tricky problem you just can't get around. You don't speak the language there. Well, Helsinki, the capital of Finland, could be a possibility. According to the mayor, the city has a shortage of workers. The mayor wants foreigners to relocate to the city for the sake of the economy. So he's got an idea. Make English an official language there. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry has more.
Here's the thing about the Finnish language. It's really hard for foreigners to learn. Finnish grammar is super complicated. There's no future tense, just for one example. And it has some of the longest words in the world.
Epäjärjestelmällistymättömyydelläänsä känköhän.
That's Finnish comedian Ismo. He tells me that word doesn't actually make much sense in English.
It kind of like roughly could be translated somehow like, I doubt that probably not even with his ability to be disorganized.
Even Ismo, a native Finn, admits his mother tongue can be challenging. Finnish doesn't sound anything like most European languages. For example,
like mother, that's like kind of similar in most languages, like mamma, mutter, mother, ma, something like that. But in Finnish, mother is äiti.
Finnish is not even the only official language in Finland. Swedish is also spoken there. And public sector workers are expected to be fluent in both. Penelope Rue, who's from the UK, has been living in Finland for 20 years. Still, when I ask her if she's fluent in Finnish, she says,
no, definitely not, no. And even now, I think I would really struggle to have a proper conversation with somebody.
Rue says that's not just because the Finnish language is so tough to learn.
One of the excuses that a lot of us foreigners give is that every time we try and use our Finnish, Finns answer us in perfect English. So you feel almost guilty about making them sort of suffer with your very elementary Finnish, when actually it would be much more efficient if both people just spoke English.
Rue didn't need fluent Finnish to get her first job as an English teacher in Finland, but others haven't been so lucky. New Yorker Kimberly Gowdy moved there in 2018 for love, and she was determined to find work.
There were 47 positions that I applied for formally.
Eventually, Gowdy was called for an interview, but she says her lack of Finnish made it all a bit of a struggle.
I did as much Finnish as I could, and then I switched into English, and I think it really rubbed them the wrong way. But I was like, I'm doing the best I can.
Gowdy didn't get the job, and she's since set up her own business outside of the capital. The mayor of Helsinki is Johanna Vartiainen. He says expecting foreigners to speak fluent Finnish is unreasonable. If Helsinki wants to attract internationals to come and work there, he says, making English an official language will help. Miska Hakala is delighted with the idea. He's with Helsinki Business Hub, which helps foreign companies set up shop in the capital.
Helsinki has become much more international. It attracts much more international people and talent and investors. And I see that as a great opportunity for people to actually come to here.
He set up a program for foreign tech workers and their families to come to Finland for 3 months last year. It's called the 90-Day Finn Scheme. Thousands applied. Hakala says some of those workers are now planning to stay long term. But not everyone is taken with the mayor's suggestion.
I don't see that there is a need for that because in Helsinki people speak English.
Arja Haparkorpi is with the social sciences faculty at Tampere University. She says it's the healthcare sector and the restaurant business that really need workers. And these employees do need to be able to speak Finnish to their customers. Haparkorpi says this English language proposal might be more of a publicity stunt by the mayor than anything else.
He's just starting his career. So I don't think that he's totally 100% serious with that proposal.
But for anyone thinking of moving to Finland, I ask comedian Ismo if there are any words that foreigners should absolutely learn.
Well, olut or kalja. Olut, that would be like ale, and kalja is beer.
There's no word for please in Finnish. So Ismo says, if you just walk up to the bar and say
kalja,
that should do the trick. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Russian President Vladimir Putin announced today he's going into self-isolation after possible exposure to COVID. Just prior to that, however, he met with Syria's President Bashar al-Assad. Russia militarily intervened on behalf of Assad's government in 2015. Since then, Russia's bombing campaigns in Syria have left many dead and wounded. Russia has also played the role of conflict mediator between the Syrian government and opposition rebels. To better understand Russia's role in Syria, we got in touch with Mona Yakubian. She's a senior advisor at the United States Institute of Peace in Washington. Mona, let's start with the meeting between Assad and Putin. What was that about?
I think that first shows very clearly how beholden Assad is to Putin. But we also see, I think, Russia trying to shape the narrative on Syria, trying to gain greater legitimacy for Assad. This is following the presidential election this past spring, widely viewed as a sham election. And I think Russia also attempting to demonstrate its influence in Syria, in the Middle East more broadly.
I was going to ask sort of why did Russia intervene in the first place? I mean, why does Syria matter to Russia?
Well, it came in the wake of course, the Arab uprisings. And the Assad regime was in great trouble in 2015 and was truly, it was truly facing an existential threat. And this is what prompted Moscow to intervene on behalf of the Assad regime, of course, along with Iran, which had also intervened earlier and remains another key sort of ally of the Assad regime on the ground in Syria.
But why Syria? I mean, there's uprisings all over the globe. What's Russia's real interest in Syria?
Well, Russia's had a longstanding interest in Syria. I mean, Russia has been involved in Syria for decades, well before Bashar al-Assad, during the time of his father, Hafez al-Assad. And again, I think the Middle East is, of course, a strategic part of the world, and Russia has long sought to demonstrate its influence on the ground. And again, I do think the Arab uprisings were an important happening in terms of the way Putin perceived these uprisings as being a threat much more broadly, a threat that could eventually even come to Russia.
Russia continues to drop bombs in opposition-held territories in Syria. Do you see this continuing for the foreseeable future?
I think we are going to continue to see it, although, again, more sporadically, not the sorts of large-scale offensives that provoked large displacement, large flows of Syrians fleeing either to other parts of the country or out of the country as refugees. I do think we will continue to see the Russians and, of course, the Assad regime use military force where and how they can to make small gains on the ground. But I think the battle lines in Syria right now are largely frozen.
Russia's also tried to play a mediator role in Syria between the government and opposition rebels. Has it made any progress?
Well, this summer saw a lot of violence in southwestern Syria, a town called Dera, which is known as the cradle of the revolution. And for weeks, the Russians were attempting to mediate a truce between regime forces and rebels that were holed up in a certain part of Dera. They eventually succeeded in negotiating this truce just a few weeks ago. And that ended up allowing Syrian government forces now back into parts of Dera for the first time in several years. I think we should be under no illusion that southwestern part of Syria remains restive. It's a very complex mix of forces on the ground there.
Ultimately, Mona, what do you think is Russia's endgame in Syria?
Well, I think Russia is trying to make the best of what it's been able to achieve in its intervention in Syria. I think it sees it both for the role of being able to reestablish itself in the Middle East. It would like to use Syria as a springboard to project its influence elsewhere in the Middle East. We've seen, for example, Russian influence in places like Libya. They have shown an interest in developing relations with Gulf Arab countries, and they've also developed backroom or even frontroom understanding with Israel on how Israel comports itself in Syria. So there's a regional role that Russia is seeking to play. But I also think Russia looks at its intervention in Syria or is trying to portray it as part of what Russian analysts like to talk about as the post-West world. A world after what some have called the unipolar moment of U.S. dominance, not only in the Middle East, but in the world more broadly. And I think for some Russians, they or Russian analysts or Moscow views its intervention in Syria as a success, as what they call the first post-West success.
Mona Yacoubian is a senior advisor at the United States Institute of Peace in Washington, where she joined us from. Thanks a lot, Mona.
Thank you so much for having me.
There's bad news about a virus, and it is not the one that causes COVID-19. It's about HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. For the first time in 20 years, the decline in new HIV infections has stalled. In 2020, there were 1.5 million new infections, three times as many as predicted. The pandemic is partly to blame. It's cut off access for many people to HIV prevention, education, and testing. That's according to a new report by the nonprofit Global Fund. In the West African country of Ghana, there's also an acute shortage of antiretroviral drugs, which is endangering the health and lives of tens of thousands of HIV-positive children and pregnant women. Ridwan Karim Dini Osman reports from Ghana's capital, Accra.
Leticia Esiama sits on a wooden stool to sort out clothes for laundry. She is 5 months pregnant. She cooks and sleeps here in this single-room wooden shack in Accra. The mother of two has been living with HIV for nearly 10 years. She survives on antiretroviral drugs, but is currently almost out of stock.
The drugs are difficult to come by these days. Sometimes, even when I get to the health facilities, I see that the attendants are under so much pressure, yet there is very little they can do to help. We understand it is the coronavirus, but this is the only medication that keeps us alive.
Health experts say pregnant women like Esiama are supposed to take HIV medicines throughout pregnancy. If access to the medicine is interrupted, the mother risks passing the virus to her baby and could develop serious health issues herself. Esiama's two other children are HIV negative, but she fears the worst could happen to her third unborn child if the antiretroviral shortage is not fixed.
I have only a few tablets left. What is going to happen to me after a few days? Sometimes I feel very weak, and I'm afraid I'm going to die or even infect the innocent baby in my womb.
The great majority of HIV infections in Ghana at the end of 2020 were in women. Leticia Esiama is among more than 5,000 HIV-positive pregnant women grappling with the current scarcity of antiretroviral medications. ARV's shortages are not new, but the latest shortage has been extremely critical, not only for pregnant women, but also the nearly 30,000 children living with HIV here. In the Ashanti regional town of Obuasi in southern Ghana, the situation is a double whammy for this widow with HIV-positive twins. Due to stigma, she does not want to be identified, but laments that for some time now, several efforts to get pediatric drugs for her babies have proved futile.
For 1 week.
Sometimes I roam so many facilities before I get the medication, and the supply is often for just a few days. At some point, I stopped roaming because I am a widow and the transportation cost was becoming too much for me. But weeks later, we started having skin rashes and developing sores on the mouth.
The latest report from UNAIDS warns that if the drug shortage persists, around 50% of children living with HIV will die before they reach their second birthday.
I am afraid now that when I go for review, the results will show poor suppression levels. I am always on my knees, asking God to keep us alive because I feel the children don't deserve this. At least we should be given supplies that will last longer.
According to the United Nations, many children acquired HIV in 2020 during the height of COVID-19. Due to lockdowns and school shutdowns, there has been less access for children to HIV prevention programs, as well as testing that could quickly identify when someone has the disease before they spread it. And even before the pandemic, pediatric HIV medication was in particularly short supply. Ghana's National AIDS Control Program says the pandemic has also adversely impacted production of the life-saving medicines and their supply and transportation, leading to increases in costs. The program's manager, Stephen Asiado, says this has eroded Ghana's progress on the goals to end HIV and AIDS.
We are working very hard to improve the pipeline, the supply chain, especially for the exposed babies.
These medicines, as well as the COVID-19 vaccine, can't come fast enough for people living with HIV. Dr. Meg Doherty is the WHO Director of HIV, Hepatitis and STI Programs.
Considering that people living with HIV have a 30% increased risk of death if they are hospitalized, people living with HIV should be prioritized for early COVID vaccines.
Elsie Ayer is worried the West brunt of COVID-19 is being borne by the most vulnerable in society, the same communities that carry a higher burden of HIV. She is the national president for the Ghana Network of Persons Living with HIV.
If we are able to manufacture ARVs in country, all those delays, the shortages, delays at the ports, looking for tax waivers, even it will reduce cost of us accessing ARVs.
This is also called for by UNAIDS Executive Director Winnie Byanyima. She addressed a high-level meeting on AIDS at the UN headquarters in New York this year.
Let us ensure that all medicines which can prevent deaths of people living with HIV are manufactured by multiple producers, including producers in the global south.
In the interim, Byanyima wants the international community to urgently institute measures to mitigate the impact of higher costs and scarcity of antiretroviral medicines.
We're not just interconnected. We are inseparable. We cannot end AIDS in one country or one continent. We can only end AIDS everywhere.
For the world, this is Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
Reporting for this story was supported by the National Geographic Society's COVID-19 Emergency Fund for Journalists. Back in 2018, Boeing's MAX 737 jet gained worldwide attention when two of the planes crashed within months of each other, one in the Java Sea off Indonesia and one in Ethiopia, killing nearly 350 people. Tom Jennings is the director of a new documentary called Boeing's Fatal Flaw.
But then at 5,000 feet, the plane was fluctuating up and down, and then the plane just started diving. It just didn't make sense.
The film is a production of Frontline, also produced here at GBH in Boston. Jennings joins me now from New York. Tom, your film condenses years of investigative journalism. I'm going to ask you to condense even further. In the end, what brought the two Boeing planes down?
There is not one individual who brought down the 737 MAX. It was all about groupthink. It was about a certain kind of inertia at the Federal Aviation Administration, the regulator, but it was also the corporation itself and how it had come to believe in its own sense of mission and engineering capacities, its ability to do no wrong.
What technically went wrong with the planes? I mean, what was the technical issue?
There was a software program embedded into the cockpit. It was called MCAS. It was all about letting the pilots handle the plane effectively. That program, though, was designed in a way that was only for the highest or the most rare and extreme circumstances. But Boeing decided at a certain point to implement that at normal operating levels. And that problem with that was if there was a malfunction with that MCAS system at low levels, the pilots didn't have time to respond to it if it went into a malfunction. And that's exactly what happened in both the flights that went down.
The documentary goes over the context in which the 737 MAX was brought to market, even though there were a host of red flags within Boeing. Here's one of your New York Times collaborators.
All of this comes out of trying to give airlines the most fuel-efficient version of a plane that they can spend as little money training their pilots on.
To what extent was this a corporate culture problem, and to what extent was this just plain malfeasance on Boeing's part, or was it both?
It's both. It's malfeasance in the sense that there was a demand placed upon the engineering design process from the highest ranks, from the CEO level down, to contain costs. Because of that pressure that Natalie Kitroev in the clip was talking about, the airlines were demanding a very fuel-efficient, cost-effective airplane. Any kind of thing that went into the design process that effectively increased the cost to the airlines was really looked down upon. That resulted in a full-on attempt to reduce the cost of training of pilots.
It's interesting. The crashes both happened in developing countries, Indonesia and Ethiopia. A man who you interviewed in Ethiopia lost five people in his family in the crash and was told it wasn't Boeing's fault.
I remember the Boeing company blaming what they call the foreign pilots.
and deflecting blame to them, saying they are the cause.
Did that feel like a significant detail to you, the sort of blaming of the pilots?
Oh, yes, for sure. That was Kwindos Karanja, yes. He lost 5 of his family members on the Ethiopian Airlines flight. There were times when Boeing insinuated very strongly that the pilots were at fault. Boeing and a lot of people in the United States believe that American pilots would not have been in that circumstance because of higher levels of training that they've had and more experiences than, say, developing country pilots have had. There is a large sense of the debate weighted towards the blame towards the developing country pilots that was probably undeserved in this case.
One thing that's striking about your documentary is what is not there. Boeing wouldn't talk to you. The FAA wouldn't talk to you. I mean, where is the accountability?
Of the two, I'm more a little, I guess, journalistically aggrieved that the Federal Aviation Administration wouldn't. They are public servants, after all. They refuse to comment. And Boeing, you know, they just have the sense that there's nothing that they could say in the light of 346 deaths that would make them look any better than they do. And they didn't look very good. And they're hoping desperately to just move on. It's not something that the families, though, would really agree with. They're still suffering. They're still grieving for the losses that they encountered.
Boeing 737 MAXs are back in the air today. Were any changes made to the plane before they were put back into flight?
Yeah. The MCAS system was given a second failsafe. It gives the pilots much more flexibility. It gives them a sense that they're in control, and they know about MCAS now. So FAA put its rubber stamp on it, and now we have about 300 of the 737 MAX flying around the world in service.
Would you ride in one?
I would. I would ride in a 737 MAX. I mean, it's the most tested airplane now in the world. I'd be cautious. I've become much more cautious about flying. I think that there's a lot of this groupthink that goes into play that we don't know about. And I'm suspicious of the safety records generally.
Tom Jennings is the director of Frontline's new documentary, Boeing's Fatal Flaw, out this week on PBS. Thanks a lot, Tom.
Thank you.
If the name Cristiano Ronaldo does not ring a bell, just know this. He's one of the highest paid soccer players in the world. But it's his diet, not just his prowess on the pitch, that's rubbing off on his new teammates. At the English Premier League club Manchester United, goalkeeper Lee Grant let loose a little gossip from a recent team dinner. Here he is on the UK's Talk Sport Network.
What's Cristiano got on his plate? So we're all having a little goosey gander over what he's got. And obviously it's the cleanest, most healthy plate you can imagine. And it just cracked me up how not one single player dared get up and take that junk food on, which was laid out.
That's right. No pudding, brownie, or apple crumble. No dessert, Ronaldo. And by the sounds of it, that goes for the rest of Man United. But what was on Cristiano's plate?
Quinoa and avocado and a couple of boiled eggs. That was one of the plates. I didn't get to see the other one.
It's making me think of ice cream. And getting out of here. That's our cherry on top for today. The World comes to you each day from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
Before we go, just a quick reminder that now through June 14th, we are asking listeners to support our work. Your generosity helps power our nonprofit newsroom so we can continue to bring you the best in international reporting with nuance and with care. Help us reach our goal of $25,000 by making a gift today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thanks so much.